Session number 6229, reel 8.
This is Collie reel 8. Is there anything about the way in which your day-to-day life was organized when you moved to the Atab huts that was markedly different from previously?
Yes, because now we were more of an enlarged community. Of course, we were enlarged because the numbers had grown so vastly. And we were no longer able to live in a sort of little enclosed congsies as we had before, partly due to the fact the size of each hut. And so there was much more of a communal existence than there had been before. We were forced into being a community, which involved, of course, a different idea of running the camp. By the time we left the houses, we had elected a new commandant because the doctor, who'd originally been the commandant for a long time, had realized that with her medical work, as well as having to answer every call of the Japs, had abdicated that in favor of someone else. We had elected another commandant who was an American married to an English woman who was very, very efficient indeed, an extremely efficient woman who was completely unflappable and calm and exactly the sort of person who was very good to deal with the Japanese. It was rather funny, actually. Her name was Hinch. And the word in Japanese for one is inchi. And there was one of the guards, because we had a lot of guards, we always gave them nicknames depending on their peculiarities. And this one we called our Fat, because he was very fat. And he had a habit of coming into the camp in his pajamas, sort of afternoon, I suppose, he put on these brightly coloured pyjamas, usually yellow or something, I assumed to have his siesta or something. And if he came in and suddenly in the afternoon, he would come in these bright pyjamas and shrieking, Inchi, Inchi, Inchi. Well, it was rather funny because her name was Hinch. I think he really meant number one, who was the commandant. They were called her number one. Mm. But as her name was Hinch, it was really very funny.
It was a nice coincidence,
and, yes, mm. Inchy, Inchy, Inchy. And as we always used to say, she would emerge looking perfectly calm against this raging Jap, probably red in the face and shrieking about something. And she would just appear calm and ask him what he wanted. And it was really quite amusing to watch this interplay of this raging little fat man in his yellow silk pajamas and this very calm, this very calm woman on our side, their commandant, who confronted this. They nearly always used to rage. I suppose this is the usual thing with foreigners. If they think you don't understand, they shout. So, of course, that was probably accounted for the shouting that they did. Also added to that, we had quite a lot of tall people in the camp. A lot of the English women were quite tall. And, of course, most of the Japanese were quite short. And I think this made them feel a little bit inferior, you know. It wasn't good for their morale to have to look up to us when they wanted to shriek and put us in our place. Not that it affects me, because I'm short, but there were a lot of tall women, and they could look down at these little raging men. And I remember one woman who was, she had been, I don't know if I said this before, but she had been a model. Stop me if I said this before. She had been a model at one time in her life, and she was very tall. She was nearly 6 foot, and by this time she was very thin. Added to which, she was very deaf. And I don't know what she did one day to enrage this Jap sentry, but something, I suppose, she was doing quite unwittingly. And he was a particularly short Jap. I should think he was only 5 foot, and she was nearly 6. And so he stood in front of her with his fists clenched, raging at her and having to look up to her. And she half bent her head because she couldn't hear anyhow. In any case, he was talking in Japanese. And he got so infuriated that he aimed to slap her face, but of course missed and swept under her chin. And having done that with one hand, he then swept the other one out and missed her again. And it was really an absolute hoot. Those of us who witnessed it, you know, we were absolutely standing in corners witnessing this and hooting. And he was so disgusted, he walked off. He didn't make another attempt, but it was so I can understand how frustrating he must have felt.
And the loss of face as well.
Trying to slap her face and missing by inches, sweeping his hand under her chin and another one under her chin. It was really ludicrous. It was sort of a farcical situation.
We were talking about the ways in which the style and the organisation of life changed with the enlargement and the move.
Mrs. Hinch was then the commandant, and she remained the commandant until the end. And then, of course, there were the chores in regard to the camp duties. As I said, the bathrooms and the latrines. And the general clearing up, of course, was on a much bigger scale. Instead of being able to do it individually in our own houses, as we'd done in the houses, now it had to be done on a far bigger scale. But still it was done on the system of volunteers. And people, you know, were asked. Somebody would come through the hutments and say, oh, we need something or other, volunteers for this. We did try to arrange it among ourselves that nobody had to do it two or three times. And we did try to make our own roster say, oh, no, you did it yesterday, you know. But there was no absolutely somebody walking round and saying, it's your turn, it's your turn. But everything did get done. Everybody, I mean, really noble people who did so many of the unpleasant chores, and they seem to always be doing it. But there you are. That, you know, that was how it worked. But we did. Then, of course, the cooking that had to be done commonly. Well, now, of course, they had to have volunteer cooks because this was a very strenuous thing, and. Well, for one thing, not everybody was able to do it because it was a very hard job to cook so much rice in these huge cauldrons. And then somebody had to be there to feed the fire. And then the rice always had to be washed such a lot of times. It wasn't just a case of a couple of washes. And then to wash it, you had to go and collect the water. And most of the time, the water in the camp was off. And we had to go down the hill from the camp to a standpipe. And it was quite a half a mile down, and then carry the water back. And all this had to be done back and forth again. You know, a long job and a very heavy job carrying pails of water up and down. The rice had to be washed dozens of times, depending what state it was in. Vegetables had to be prepared. And then when the rice was cooked, then we had to have more people, more volunteers who would serve the rice. You had to have the rice. They were put into buckets. The rice was put out into big buckets. And then these buckets went to the dormitories, to the various dormitories, so that then somebody there would be ready to serve the people in their particular hut. And so we had to get this system working, that there was always somebody in the kitchen to get the rice in the bucket for their dormitory, carry it to their dormitory. Somebody was waiting in the dormitory or just outside the dormitory to serve the rice then into individual portions, and whatever vegetables or soup or whatever went with it was the same system. Somebody went to the kitchen and collected it for each dormitory, took it, and then somebody was there to serve it when it came up, so that it was a much bigger operation altogether than when we had been only cooking for 8, 10, 12, 15 people. It turned into a very much bigger operation altogether.
And did the rations deteriorate during this period?
Yes, and they also had a very unpleasant way of bringing the rations up and sometimes leaving them outside. I know on one occasion we were particularly incensed because they brought up a lot of carrots, which looked quite good actually, and they just threw them in a pile on the ground and then wouldn't give them out. And they stayed there in the sun for a couple of days, then they gave them to us. By that time they were practically inedible because by that time in the sun, in the climate like that, they deteriorated and gone mouldy and limp and horrible. And when they came up, they looked all right. We never discovered why, whether they did it just to be nasty or whether they had any reason, I don't know. Of course, a lot of things that seemed completely unreasonable to us, they might have had a reason for, but what it was, we never fathomed.
What else deteriorated or became unavailable in the food line?
Well, I suppose. Well, we didn't get a lot of fruit. It was green things we needed so much. We noticed the lack of green vegetables. We were absolutely crying out for green vegetables. I remember one of the missionaries said one day, one of the children leant through the barbed wire and was picking some green leaves. And, of course, this woman was older and she couldn't do this. And she said, I never thought I'd feel like stealing from a child. She said, but I felt I could have snatched that stuff from the child. And, because we felt anything green, which has lasted me. I don't know whether I was always so fond of green vegetables as I am now, but now I miss them terribly. I felt as if I've never caught up. Even to this day, I eat vast quantities of green vegetables, and I'm much more than anybody I ever meet. And, I really devour green vegetables, almost as if I'm trying to make up. But it was a very, very great loss. And the fruit that we got, what we had to buy, which, of course, would have made up for it, was in such small quantities. I mean, you might be able to buy, and bananas don't make up. You wanted things like, we needed limes and oranges and that sort of thing. Of course, we didn't get oranges. Limes were the only thing that we got. And sometimes a pineapple, but not an individual pineapple. Of course, then it would be between about 20, 30 people. So that was the sort of thing that we were greatly lacking and that we missed so much. They gave us the starchy sort of things. They brought in either tapioca roots, which, of course, are starch, or some stuff that was really chopped-up tapioca root, which they dried in the sun in the same way that some people do apples and cut them into rings and then dry them. And, you get that effect of dried apple rings. Well, they did that with the tapioca. And so you've got this very dried-up circles of stuff, which are really the tapioca root. And that, of course, was starch too, and that all had to be pounded up. That was another job we had to do in that camp, pounding. They brought us maize in as well. And I say maize, I don't even call it Indian corn, because it was just like the stuff we would feed to chickens, the very big grains of maize, not the nice ones that you get on the cob, the small new ones, but the very old big yellow grains that, as I say, I've only seen fed to chickens. Mm. And we couldn't do anything. We used to pound that. And there was in the camp, it was a bit of a tree trunk, actually, that had been hollowed out with an enormous, heavy pounder that had been made out of a chunk of wood. It was rather like an oar with a round bit on the bottom. And it was very heavy. And we used to stand astride this tree trunk up on it. It was about 18 inches high, and we would stand one foot on either side, put all the maize and stuff, or the tapioca, whatever it was, in the hollow, and then lift this pounder up and down with two hands, thumping it up and down. And it was very hard work because, as I say, all this is taking place in the tropics, where normally white people don't do heavy work. And so that was another chore. There was so much to do all the time. I think I said before on another tape that people have asked me since I came home, but what did you do all day? And the point was, we were so occupied by doing all these things in order to keep ourselves alive and clean that there was no question of what did we do. And we weren't free until the evening, and then we were so tired we just used to sink into our bed spaces.
Did you do more or less or much the same when you moved to the Attup huts from the point of view of recreation, social activities,
pastimes of one sort? It lessened quite a bit, although the music increased, actually, because by that time they'd really got it very well organized. There were some of the girls, well, one woman who had been a trained musician, and she had got together a choir she taught them in parts, and they hummed, and purely by using their mouths and vocal sounds, they produced what sounded like an orchestra, and it was very, very clever indeed. And so the people who were musical, I should say there must have been about 30 of them, and they used to have these practices. They used the kitchen when the kitchen wasn't being used. That was about the only space. And they would produce quite a number of most excellent pieces with which they would regale the camp and so on. And, of course, it was an occupation and interest for them. And, of course, we liked it too. Even if they were only rehearsing, we would still gather round to listen. And so that, I think, rather increased in that camp, because it had started in the houses, but it seemed to gather force in that camp. I think more people became interested, or I don't know whether the necessity seemed to grow, and there wasn't so much else to do. But other than that, we did drop the country dancing. I can't remember doing any country dancing in that camp. The school dwindled because there was nowhere really suitable to teach the children, although I did for a while use a little space where the rice sacks were, but it wasn't very convenient. It was very difficult to find a place suitable. And also, of course, there were so many chores to be done that we had enough to do. Mm. We dropped, of course, we used to, in the houses, we used to run little concerts for our birthdays and Christmas and all that sort of thing. And I'm afraid that rather dropped too, because it was a larger community. When we were in the houses, we could have the feeling of being in a house or a home. Even if we were in the garage, at least we were a certain number of people who felt it was our domain. Mm. But when the Hutments were so much enlarged, that we didn't get that same feeling of being in a small enough number to be a family, as it were.
Yes,
so
yes.
As far as that went, I mean, we would acknowledge people's birthdays and try and find something to give them. We'd go through our own possessions and try and find something to give them, or people who'd still got some needles and cottons would make something, or if you could pick any wild flowers, you'd make them a little pot of flowers in a coconut shell, and or anything that you happen to be able to get. We still sort of tried to acknowledge, and we tried to excuse them from all duties on their birthday. This was more or less general. We always said, no, you're not to do anything today, no work, it's your birthday. And if they'd got any decent clothes left, they'd put on their birthday clothes and sit around like ladies for a day. It was rather fun, just made something different of the day. But other than that, no, we had to drop quite a little. Still continued a church service. The missionaries always had a service of some sort on a Sunday. Most of the other things, as I say, they dwindled for lack of, well, inanition, I suppose it was, really. We hadn't the energy for a lot of the things that we'd had before.
Life became more of a struggle for survival.
Yes, much more. And the thing to do, and everybody realised it, I think in the first camp, we always had that feeling, it can't last, they can't keep us here, you know, we're not doing any good, we're no good to them, surely they will repatriate us, surely they'll get rid of us. And I think for the first year, probably, we'd always got that feeling that somehow or other it wouldn't last. But once we'd been put into them, it seemed that sort of hope died, and we just realised, I think, more than we had before, that this is for the duration of the war, and if we can survive, well, we only on our own sheer holding on capacity, our sheer capacity for struggle, if we managed to get through this, it was, it was a different feeling altogether.
How did morale change with these changing situations?
Well, as I suppose that was the way it did change, that people didn't seem quite as hopeful as they had done before. And I think most people, just had to feel they were living from day to day. And I think that was the sort of feeling that we all had. I'll get through today. You thought, you didn't really think, what am I going to do tomorrow? You sort of, thought for today and live for the day, if you could get through the day. that was it, you know. And then the next day dawned, and that was another day to get through. Of course, while we were there, we had to. That was this was the camp where we had to. They suddenly came in and made us dig up this ground that was in between the camps, and they suddenly made us dig all this up and plant things. I suppose they realised we weren't getting enough green things, and so they made us plant, and that was terribly difficult because, although I think I've said this before, it was just like digging cement, although it wasn't cement, it was just the hard-packed earth. They brought in big gardening, well, their sort of gardening implements for us to dig up, and then they really did make us do. Now, this was one of the things the Japs made us do, that they insisted that we all took turns in doing this. Of course, eventually, some of the people paid somebody else to do it, naturally. But, I mean, at first, the Japs said everybody had to do it. And we used to start at 6:30 in the morning and continue on. I've forgotten what the shift was, about a couple of hours or something. And then somebody, another squad came on and another one came on. And I think all through the morning and afternoon, trying to dig up this ground and then plant sweet potatoes and tapioca, and that was with the idea of giving us more food and some green stuff, I suppose. Well, we did pick the leaves off the ubis, and then towards the end of the time there were air raids, and obviously, I suppose, Americans. Now, I mean, I've learned since, we didn't know at the time who it was, but obviously there were air raids, and that caused a lot of confusion, and the guards were rushing around. And at one point they gathered us all together, and they told us that we might have to leave the camp if we were being bombed, and we were to go into the jungle, but we were not to go any further, and when it was over we had to come back, and they would go with us, they would protect us, which rather amused us. Imagine us all fleeing out into the jungle, and they were going to be our protectors from the air raids. But they did obviously get very jittery, and food did deteriorate. I rather think, you see, there was more pressure than we realised. We didn't know what was happening, obviously, but I think there must have been quite a bit of pressure from probably the Americans, and I think that this was causing quite a disturbance, and probably accounted for the shortage of food and so on. And I think that was probably the reason in the end, although they said it was for our benefit, that they moved us to Muntok. And that was when we did the next journey to Muntok. Mm. And I think that it was really because they realised. Of course, you see, Palembang, you may remember, had oil refineries there, so that it was a very great objective for bombing. Naturally, it would be a target. And we were near enough to the town to at least get perhaps stray bombs. Mm. And
to take you back to this this business of realizing at Palembang that there was no hope, or there was much less hope, that you were there for the duration. Did that affect any people's spirits in any extreme form?
Well, I can only say what I saw myself. I don't know, I suppose everybody was downhearted. Yes, I think so. But I don't think anybody felt that they were never going to get out. I must say, I don't think that people just sat down and said, well, we'll never get out of this. I think there was always the hope was there, but even if it was going to be, you know, a distant hope, I think that everybody thought they just got to sit it out and wait for the end. But I didn't come across anybody who actually said, well, we'll never get out of this alive, you know, I might just as well die, sort of thing. I think that everybody felt it was getting more distant, but at least I think they determined, most people seemed to be determined to hang on for that time, however long it was going to be. But of course, when people are ill and tired, and we got itched there, we were always scratching, we'd got this awful skin thing, and that I felt that was worse than times when I was ill. Terrible, you know, you couldn't sleep at night for scratching, and oh dear, that was a most, it was a dreadful thing. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And that rushed round the camp, and then the Japs even made fun of us and said, you know, all these women do is go about scratching. And I must tell you this, when the girls, and I told you, some of the volunteers, our noble volunteers who used to empty the cesspits for us, they had to do it every day. We had to also fertilise the gardens with this stuff, so a lot of it was put on the gardens. But did I tell you? Perhaps I can't remember whether I put this on the other tape. Anyway, somebody apparently had offended the Japs in some way. I don't know what it was, but there we are. We very seldom knew what we'd done to offend them. Somebody had done something they considered was wrong. And so they said that they had to be the ones to fertilise. They'd got to do it. They'd got to do the fertilising. And so these girls got up early, about half a dozen of them, I think. And they said, first of all, they'd got to go to the Japs' houses. They had houses just outside the camp. We could see through the gaps in the wooden partitions that we could see these houses. And they had just little Dutch little bungalows that had been inhabited by the Dutch. And gardens, and they had planted, I suppose they'd got their junior ranks to plant their gardens, like just ordinary little gardens belonging to small houses. And they told these girls, first of all, to take the manure and put it on their gardens. And so they thought this was a wonderful opportunity. So that they dashed and they got as much of this stuff as they could. And they rushed and they put it all under the windows of these bungalows, as near to the window as they could. And of course, you'd always had the windows, like, well, there wasn't any glass as a rule, it was just shutters, open shutters, and you close them if it rained. So they rushed, and as much of this stuff as they could, they put absolutely right under the windows, and they kept on, they were working as hard as they could, rushing before the Japs realised what they were doing, and they were literally running with these great cans of stuff and tipping it madly all under these windows. And when they'd finished, the Jap who was in charge of them, he was so pleased that they had worked so hard that he gave them each a piece of soap. Now, soap was like gold. I mean, absolutely, that was like giving them, you know, £2 or £3. And a piece of soap, unheard of. And they were each given a piece of soap because they'd worked so well and excused for their misdemeanour. And they came in absolutely triumphant with a piece of soap, and they knew this. Well, of course, in the afternoon, we all gathered with our noses so that we could see through the slits in the wood to see what happened. Of course, by the afternoon, when the sun was well up, this stuff under their windows began to exude this terrible odour. And there they were, all the Japs coming out of their houses, wondering what were all this smell. Oh, it was absolutely lovely. It was a beautiful piece of own back, you know. Talk about that. And they didn't realise, whoever was in charge of these girls hadn't realised that that was what they were up to. It was really very funny, and that to think that they got a piece of soap given to them for doing just this. Oh, dear, it was very funny.
Why was soap such a treasure?
Well, we just couldn't get it. We couldn't even buy it. And we'd used all we'd taken in. And they sent in sometimes a bar of yellow soap, which, I mean, I haven't seen since I was a child and was called, you know, household soap that you'd only use for scrubbing the floor. And also, it was absolutely new and soft, so that if you'd put it into water, it would have absolutely dissolved immediately. So we had to put it in the sun to dry out, and then of course it shrank terribly. And instead of a bar of soap, say about 12 inches long, it was crinkled up and grew smaller. And when we cut it up into little pieces and distributed it, we'd probably get a piece about 3/8 of an inch deep, a little wafer of soap, and it was this horrible yellow soap that normally, as I say, you'd only use for the floor. Well, we'd only use it for washing our clothes then. But we just used to have to put our clothes through water and, I mean, hope for the best, just hoping that putting them in water and thoroughly rubbing them and putting them in the sun. The sun was a great thing, of course, because if you spread the things in the sun and they really got cooked and scorched in the sun, we felt that that was as near as we could get to getting them clean. But we were very, very short of soap. They suggested at one point that with these communal fires, we should collect all the ash from the burning wood and make soap. Well, none of us has had any experience of making soap. I don't know to this day how to make soap out of wood ash, but apparently that is one of the ingredients that you can use. But we never fathomed it, but they expected us to do that. You should collect that. You should make some soap out of it. Really very silly.
Were there any other routine aspects of life that were important at Pelham Ballet?
Well, the water question was always very acute there. We were on a bit of a hill, and whether it was the fact that we were on a bit of a hill and the pressure wouldn't bring the water up to us, or whether there was really a serious shortage, but I think there must have been a shortage. And the pipe, stand pipe that we had to go down to, which was about half a mile away, only ran for a certain number of hours a day. And we used to be assembled with all our buckets and containers. It wasn't necessarily a bucket. You perhaps have a butter tin with a bit of wire over it, or anything that would hold water. Could have been a cooking utensil or anything you had that would hold water. And we'd assemble at the gates and be counted to go down to collect the water. And then the guard would solemnly count us and make a note of how many were going out. And out we'd go down this hill and